Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode number 11 of the Misfit Faith podcast. I'm your host, Jason Stillman, sitting as usual at home in my office or my study. Not wearing my bathrobe today. I'm dressed in actual civilian, outdoor, grown-up, adult clothing because I went to the doctor this morning. More on that in a little bit. A couple things by way of introduction as usual. Patreon.com/Jason Stillman is right now the best way that you can support me and the work that I'm doing. You'll notice that I have added two new tiers to my Patreon page. There is a $5 tier and there is a $30 tier. The $5 tier is for anyone who pledges that much per month. What you get is access to my forthcoming book, As I Write It. As you know, I'm working on a daily devotional, kind of a sort of subversive daily devotional, not really a parody, but just an offbeat kind of look at Christian daily devotionals. It's called Our Daily Dread. And what I've committed to do is posting entries every week as I write them on Patreon that are unlocked to all $5 patrons and above. And so kind of cool. You get to read the book as I write it. If you spot any typos, let me know. If you got any ideas, pushback, feedback, let me know. It's almost like a collaborative thing between my patrons and me. So kind of a cool little benefit there if you are willing to become a patron for $5. There's also a $30 tier. The $30 tier is pretty awesome because what it gives you access to is my audiobook for Misfit Faith, and it's not just the standard version, it's the deluxe edition of the audiobook for Misfit Faith. This involves me drinking whiskey, reading the entire book, introduction and all six chapters. I go off script on tangents at times, and I provide musical segues between the sections. And also, if you've read the book, you know that I quote a lot of movies and a lot of TV shows in the book. And every single one of those, in the audio version, at least this deluxe version available only on Patreon, I actually provide the real clips from the films and from the shows. Now, eventually this will be available on Audible, but it'll be a standard version without all those extra bells and whistles because of copyright issues. So for now, the way that you can have access to that, you can download it or just listen on Patreon, is by becoming a patron to the tune of $30, and you will have access to the Misfit Faith audiobook. It took me a long time to do it, to read it all, to edit it down, to add all of the extra features and stuff. So it was a labor of love. It took a long time. It's probably about a good 7 hours of audio, and I think it's absolutely worth that $30. And so some of you have actually edited your pledges up to that level to get access. So I wanted to say, first of all, thanks to both Sam and Michael who edited their pledges up. And Hagere and Laura are new patrons as well, and so I wanted to thank you guys so much for your support. Also, continue to let me know via jasonstillman.com/membership if membership in the Misfit Faith community is something you're interested in. I've gotten a lot of feedback. Probably about 25 or so people have written and said, yes, when this launches, I want to be a part of it. If you're thinking about it, then please go to the website, jasonstillman.com/membership. There's a short form. It's just your basically your name and email. And send me that so I can kind of gauge interest and keep track. And eventually I want to have an email list of everybody who's expressed interest in this. So it really helps me to kind of get a feel for how interested people are in this. If you don't know much about it, basically it's going to be a membership in a private online group on Facebook. There will be weekly live video chats, probably on Saturdays at some time when most people are available. Those will be archived as well for people who can't join in live. The chats will be archived. We're going to go through books together. We're going to have readings. We're going to talk about provocative, interesting theological, biblical topics. There'll be back and forth, Q&A, discussion, all of that kind of thing. And so, you know, there's that, and there's also the aspect of being able to connect with other people like you who feel like misfits, who feel like, you know, outsiders, outliers, whatever you want to call it, people who just don't really fit the mold of what spirituality is supposed to be according to the gatekeepers of holiness or whatever. So that is something I'm very excited about, and I'm kind of looking at early spring, a month or two from now or so, to launch this. I'd really love to have 40 people committed. And so if you're interested in that, and if you have not yet done so, please let me know. Also, I'm kicking around the idea, and I've mentioned this before, of a promotional offer whereby if you refer somebody and they actually sign up, then you get a free month. So, you know, keep that in mind. If you are interested in this, but you are maybe short on cash or don't know how you could swing it, well, if you refer a friend and they sign up, then bam, free month for you. So keep that in mind. Let me know if that's something you're interested in. Also, share me on social media and write me an iTunes review. I've got about 18 ratings. I think I've got 8 reviews for this show. Haven't been any in a week or two, so get on there, write me a review, give me 5 stars, and I'd really appreciate it. If you think the show sucks, then please don't do that. Just walk away. No one needs that negativity. All right, enough self-promotion. Let's get on with it. Last week we talked about what I called fascist faith and trickle-down living. Now, I want to kind of reiterate some of the things I said last week, and I want to take these things a little bit further as well. Now, in my mentoring that I do with people who are kind of undergoing, you know, spiritual identity crises or whatever, you know, people who are struggling with really kind of figuring out who they are and what they believe, you know, maybe they've been burned by the church. These things that I've been talking about and that I'll unpack a bit more today have been very, very helpful and transformative for people. And so pay attention, because this is good stuff. I eventually want to perhaps put this stuff in the form of a book, but in the meantime, I'll just reflect upon it here and welcome your feedback. But we've talked about last week how that in order to break free from the slavery of fascist faith and trickle-down living. And by fascist faith, what I meant was when truth, with a capital T, is kind of imposed upon you from on high, right? When some authority outside of yourself is invested by you with the power to dictate to you what you should believe. Now, that authority might be the Bible, it might be the Pope or the church or the tradition or your favorite spiritual teacher, whoever. But when we receive truth, dogma, teaching, doctrine, whatever, theological, spiritual ideas from some authority that we are not able to question, then I'm calling that fascist faith, because it's imposed from the sky down. And what that leads to is trickle-down living, right? As I said last week, we simply allow those truths to shape us into whatever they will, and we kind of have a passive relationship with who we become, because we're not allowed to question authority, because who are we to do that, right? And so therefore, we simply sit back and let these ideas that we receive from on high shape us into whatever they will. And what I've been arguing is that in order to break free from this, we need to think outside the box. We need to allow our own narrative to be front and center. Okay, this is where real transformation happens, I would argue. So this is a kind of subversive approach to the way things are commonly done. You know, we're exploring the possibility of putting what I say the practical cart before the theoretical horse. All right? So rather than starting in the clouds with heady ideas whose lived out ramifications are unclear, I'm suggesting that why not begin on the ground and build up from there, right? That's why I call it anarchist faith, right? It's organized, but it's organized from the bottom up. We're building our identity from the ground up. If deep down we know the kinds of people we want to be, then perhaps we should begin in the trenches and then reverse engineer a set of spiritual ideas that are most likely to produce the results we know we desire, right? And so instead of saying, well, this is true, A, B, and C are true because my authority figure tells me so, and so therefore I have really no responsibility for the asshole that I have become since believing these things, rather than doing things in that order, which is the common way things, most common way things are done, I'm suggesting that maybe we should start with ourselves and start with the kinds of people we know we want to be. And so we might say, and I'll flesh this out a bit more in a moment, but we might say, I want to be a merciful person. I want to be a loving and compassionate person. And so I'm going to start there. In other words, I'm not going to just accept imposed ideas and then hope that in a year or so they make me loving and compassionate and merciful. But instead, I'm going to decide that that's who I want to be at the beginning. And then I'm going to look for spiritual ideas that are most likely to get me there. And so in this way, dogma is kind of disrupted. And spirituality is rooted in the earth. It's fastened to the ground where, you know, the theological rubber meets the road of real life hurting and marginalized people. Right? And so we're taking charge of our personal stories, and we begin with determining, as I said, who we are, who we want to be, what the best version of ourselves looks like. Now, let me unpack this with regard to my own thinking, right? So let me get personal here for a minute. Who do I want to be? Well, first of all, I want to be a unifying person. Okay, I want to be somebody who, all things being equal, I fall on the side of unity rather than separateness. Okay, I want to be somebody who's open to bringing people together, to be to oneness, to seeing myself not in distinction from, but in common with other people. Okay, the kind of person who would rather build a bridge than a wall. Okay, so that's one thing I want to be true of me. I think that that is a good, praiseworthy, respectable thing to want to be. But on top of that, I want to be somebody who also respects diversity. You see, there's more than one way to achieve unity. One way to achieve unity is to just stomp out all voices of disagreement. One way to achieve unity is to simply squash rebellion, right? One way to achieve unity is to simply impose some hegemonic arrangement whereby everyone is exactly the same. You know, it reminds me of that, the guy, who's the dude in Iran, the president or the whatever the hell he is, the prime minister of Iran, said something 5 years ago or so about homosexuality. He says, in Iran, we have no problem with homosexuality. Well, yeah, because you just kill all the homos, right? I mean, that's one way to get everyone on the same page, is to just murder the opposition. Christian and I were having a discussion on drunk ex-pastors not too long ago, well, maybe a year ago now or so, I don't know, about kind of what society will look like, what America will look like 50 years down the road, where intermarriage, interracial marriage and relationships are no longer taboo, they're no longer like illegal in the South or whatever, and people start to mix their races, and pretty soon people will kind of start looking the same. And so we're kind of springboarding off of that to, you know, what do we want society to look like? And one of the things I was arguing for in that conversation was that I don't want a society where everyone's the same. In other words, I want there to still be a Chinatown. Right? I want there to be a little Italy. I want there to be these pockets, these ghettos, these areas where a particular culture might congregate and celebrate their cultural uniqueness. And so you might have the art and the architecture and the music and the food of a particular culture in that neighborhood. In other words, I want there to be unity. I want to feel one with everybody, but not at the expense of everybody's individuality. Okay? I also want to be somebody who embraces humanity, somebody who embraces humanity with all of the weakness and the flaws and the ugliness that comes with it, right? Because I think that's the interesting stuff. A fashion model airbrushed in some glossy magazine isn't that interesting. That person might look aesthetically pleasing, but it's fake. It's synthetic. It's not real. What I like is humanity with all of the grit and dirt and messiness of it. I also want to be a person who enjoys the earth and enjoys the physical blessings of the earth. I'm not interested in being a teetotaler. I'm not interested in being an ascetic, you know, somebody who is abstaining from all of the pleasures of this world. That kind of thing just does not interest me at all. I want to drink it in. I want to eat it up. I want to indulge in it. I want to reap all the benefits of this world. I want to partake of the fruits of the earth, okay? So in this thought experiment, you know, step one of which is determining what kind of person you want to be. Well, for me, that's the kind of person I want to be. All that stuff I just got done describing. And so this might give you a little bit of insight into why Christianity and Catholicism in particular resonate with me. This is why, one of the reasons why these things make sense to me. Because in that world, you know, in that mythology of life, the overarching idea involves a God who is one, right? There is one God, right? That's the ancient Hebrew creed, right? The Lord our God, the Lord is one. And his aim is to unify, right? You can't read the New Testament and not trip right over this idea that God's plan is to unify, that there's no longer one particular nation state, one particular people, some ethnic group who distinguishes themselves by clothing and dietary restrictions and other kinds of feasts and festivals from everyone else around them. But under the new covenant, the whole aim is for something Catholic, and by Catholic I mean universal, a message that goes out to every kindred, tongue, tribe, and nation, right? And so I want that unity to be characteristic of myself. Well, in the Christian faith, you have a God like that. But at the same time, at least in the Christian story, this one God subsists in three distinct persons, right? The Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And so there is a plurality of persons within the one Godhead, right? And so, therefore, it's not unity in a kind of despotic, hegemonic way. It's not unity in the form of crushing any resistance or diversity. But within God himself, you've got a Father, a Son, and a Holy Spirit. Three persons, one God. The Father is not the Son. The Spirit is not the Father. The Son is not the Spirit. According to the story, each one is distinct, and yet they are co-equal and co-eternal and united, right? And so you've got both unity and diversity there. We are one, but we're not the same, God might say. Furthermore, according to the Christian mythology, or whatever you want to call it, religion, this God smuggled himself into the world. And he didn't do it in some sort of like reverse rapture, right? Where he's beamed down to the earth like some alien, you know, descending, coming to the earth in some sort of spectacular display of splendor and magnificence. But no, this God, according to the story, entered into this world by being born of a woman, right? By being a real flesh, bones, and blood human, right? Partaking of the exact same humanity, the same flesh and blood, the same human nature that we all share. And his goal is to actually divinize humanity. His goal is to actually deify human beings, right? This is called theosis, or divinization, in the old ancient traditions of Christianity, right? God comes to the earth in the form of a human. Why? To turn ordinary things into magic, so that regular people might become gods, as it were, icons, sacraments of the divine. And so for me, given the fact that I want to be someone who works for unity but also respects diversity, someone who appreciates humanity with all of the ugliness and messiness of it, someone who desires to partake of the fruits of this earth, not being threatened by or afraid of them because they're physical, but someone who rather who sees the beauty and the mythology and the magic behind the ordinary and the mundane. Is it any surprise that Catholicism sort of stands out to me? Is it any surprise that it resonates with me? Is it any surprise that someone like me would identify that way? And so there's an example of how, and it's kind of ironic and Chestertonian, I recognize that, kind of setting out to reverse engineer a set of spiritual ideas and ending up at orthodoxy, you know. But nevertheless, that's kind of the way my mind works. And so take that, take it out for a spin, see what it does for you. You know, for some of you, you might not desire to espouse any explicitly Christian or even spiritual claims at all, you know, as a way to ground your own mercifulness. And that's fine. You know, whatever God there might be, I'm sure he or she or it cares more about the substance of a life of love than what you call it, right? But if you are the kind of person who identifies as spiritual on some level, and perhaps even Christian on some level, then there's nothing wrong with beginning at what usually is considered the end. There's nothing wrong with putting the cart before the horse. There's nothing wrong with saying, this is the story I want my life to tell, and I'm only going to accept spiritual, biblical, theological ideas that are going to be conducive to that. In other words, perhaps it's time to let the tail wag the dogma. Now, to talk to us about this, I want to see if I can get my friend Brian Stupar on the phone. Brian is a guy that I've known since my own early days at Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa when I was in the high school ministry and working in the high school ministry for a short time after I returned from Africa. I've known the guy for years and years. He's now the pastor of Calvary Slow on the Central Coast, and he's the kind of guy who thinks outside the box. He reads outside of his own tradition, and what I love about him is that he's not afraid to self-examine and to self-criticize. So let's see if we can get Brian on the phone. Hang on. Hey, I'm looking for Brian Stupar.
Hey, what's up, Jason?
Hey, man. Good to talk to you. It's been a long time.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So, hey, we've been talking on this episode, as you know, about kind of the relationship between the things we believe and the way we behave. And, you know, we're friends on Facebook. We go way back. We've known each other. I mean, since I was in high school, I think we've known each other. So we go back a ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll see you post stuff on Facebook. You're a pastor. And I'll see you post an article or a thought or something on Facebook that I really, really always like kind of, you know, strikes a chord with me because you're often sort of expressing respect and dignity toward the other, you know, toward those in communities that Christians tend to sort of dismiss. And I sometimes notice a little bit of resistance on the part of your crowd on Facebook and a little bit of pushback and kind of heel digging. And so I kind of wanted to, you know, have you on and talk about, you know, if you've noticed that resistance from other believers when you express compassion, mercy toward, you know, supposedly sinful, undeserving people, and if so, can you give me some examples of that, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. You know, I think for one, I am a pastor, and thanks for not holding that against me. My quote unquote friends on Facebook, it's pretty broad and diverse. You know, there's people I think that are part of that community that sometimes respond that are, you know, a variety of backgrounds of faith expression, from ultra agnostic to some atheist, all the way through to, liberal and very, very right conservative, literalistic type responses as well. So yeah, I do, I think a lot of times when I try to post things, for one, I'm not necessarily looking for fights or, I post things oftentimes that are based on principle. So if I do see something that kind of resonates, first and foremost, that I think would resonate with the heart of God, I don't have any problem posting that, even though it may be like an unpopular angle within the rest of like an evangelical type of a community. And I do it with an aim of trying to create some degree of dialogue. And I realize dialogue needs to be done respectfully. And so I try to create like an atmosphere. I kind of see myself as more so trying to create an atmosphere where honest dialogue can happen. So the answer to the question is, yeah, I do find pushback sometimes. Yeah, I would say probably most of the time it might be from more of a conservative crowd, though I do sometimes even from a more liberal or left leaning type of a crowd find some as well. And I think most of the time when I try to respond, I try as much as I can, given the medium of typing and hunting and pecking for words to put on a Facebook page, to do so with respect and to give any voice the proper due respect. I think that's deserving of them. So,
what do you think it is about? Cause I've seen stuff you've posted where, it seems like the intent behind either whether it's your thought or a link to someone else's thoughts, where the intent seems to be to want to dignify and show respect toward, communities, people in communities that traditionally Christians don't have a lot of patience for, whether it's the queer community or whether it's poor people or the immigrant or whatever it might be. I always liked that you're, you seem like you're a totally free thinker and not afraid to say these things. But what do you think it is when you do get that pushback from sort of conservative evangelical folks? What do you think it is that's causing that? Like, why do you think they're digging their heels when you sort of shine a light on these issues?
Yeah, good question. I think for one, I think I would probably, though I personally, I hate labels. I don't, especially in our world, I think that tends to overuse labels and then caricature them and then redefine them accordingly. I don't like to use labels, so I wouldn't necessarily go around, call myself a conservative or evangelical, but I think in its most traditional sense, yeah, I tend to take more of a conservative slant on scripture and evangelical, meaning like I believe in the promotion of the gospel, which is the basic meaning of what evangelical is, proclamation of Jesus, the gospel. I think, with that, I try to set a standard that goes back to what does scripture teach in terms of how does Jesus have a heart for the lost, the immigrant, or even people that have sexual preferences that are different than, say, like a community of sexually conservative folk. How would Jesus treat, quote unquote, the other? I think it's a part of the conversation in our culture that needs to happen, because I think in a lot of ways, I pastor a church in a college town. So I don't know, 70% of our church is probably between ages 19 to 35. And a lot of them have kind of been brought up either in, non-Christian types of backgrounds, or what type of Christianity they have known has oftentimes been one that can be a little bit toxic or hostile towards those that, they might be rubbing their shoulders with or spending a lot of time with, say, for example, like the gay community or people that are just different than them. And so I think for me, I've tried to create an atmosphere that says, look, the way that we go about talking to each other really matters. I think the conversation begins there. And if, say, a Christian representative, someone that's representing faith, representing Jesus, begins the conversation with an assumption that they are wrong, whoever the they is, are sinners and messed up and broken and ruined people, and then they approach them with this posture of arrogance or I'm better than or whatever, then the conversation has nowhere really else to go except down from there. And it usually ends up degenerating into an argument and people parting ways with no form for communication at all. You know, I look at that. I've been brought up in, I've seen Christian traditions. I think, you know, the tradition that I'm most connected to, I've seen a lot of sort of this, I don't know, scapegoating, this caricaturing, this broad stroking another group of people. And within your own particular tribe, you kind of build a case against another person. And sometimes people have these opportunities where they actually meet others from that other group and they begin to realize like, oh, wait a minute, they are not as much of an enemy. In fact, they're nice people. You know, I had experiences like that when I first started pastoring a church, like back in 94, 95. And it started opening my eyes to the fact that maybe I've misjudged a heck of a lot of people. And I think for me, that was where somewhat of my journey began. Was sort of this dismantling of the caricatures I've had in my mind towards other people and realizing that people deserve to be heard just as much as I desperately want others to hear me. Others have, I think if you start with that assumption that I want to hear from you, I want to hear and understand your story. I want to hear where you're coming from, the angle and the perspective that you're coming from, that you're sharing. And then I think from there, the conversation can go forth.
Yeah, we were talking earlier and you used these two words that I want you to kind of unpack a little bit as we wrap up. But you were saying, you know, a lot of times the model is either one of incarnation or isolation. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could kind of flesh that out, no pun intended.
Yeah. You know, I think there's something innate to humanity where we kind of gravitate towards people that are like us, you know, whether it's same skin color or same, you know, preferences or desires or same band, or, you know, I grew up in Huntington Beach. And if you're a surfer, surfers just simply don't like commingle with jocks or bodyboarders or rollerbladers.
Oh, hell no. Hell no on the teabaggers and the rollerbladers, bro.
Yes. I mean, see, we have a lot in common here, Jason. Yet, you know, I think the reality is when we do that, that's when we go according to the natural innate way in which we already function and operate, we isolate ourselves and we gravitate towards those that are just like us. And frankly, it's actually the easier path. It really truly is the easiest path because it requires nothing out of me. It requires no sacrifice from me. It requires no responsibility on my part to ask questions of like, hey, why do you think this way? Or, you know, why do you wear rollerblades and what type of joy can you possibly get out of doing that? It requires nothing out of me. And yet what the gospel is all about at its very core is this story that says, as dysfunctional, as broken, as rebellious, as messed up as human beings were, God did not pull away. God did not cast off. God did not destroy and create a brand new universe or whatever. God actually presses into that. And that's, you know, we celebrate that at Christmas, which the big theological word for that, which if you want to impress somebody at your next party, is throw down the word incarnational. You'll sound really smart. God incarnates himself into this world and takes upon himself the fullness of this. So he fully understands what it's like to be betrayed. He fully understands what it's like to have people gossip about you, to be cast off. He totally gets it when people are abandoned. That's exactly what his experience was in this quote unquote flesh. So going back to the idea of incarnation versus isolation, you know. So for me, I tried. You know, I fail miserably often. Because sometimes, you know, I'm cranky, I'm tired, and I'm just got this enough rebel in me that says I you know, I want to do what I want to do. So isolation comes really easily for me. Incarnation takes a radical work of, you know, what the Bible would describe as God's spirit alive, doing something in me that's not natural in and of my own self. So incarnational, I would say, is this way that says, I want to get to know you before I judge you. Even though I may have already judged you, I'm going to press through my, you know, judgment of you or the reading the book by the cover. I'm going to try my best to get to know you for who you are, because you know, I wouldn't necessarily say this to everyone, but you bear the image of God. You matter to God. And therefore, you know, I'm trying to make my life so that, you know, people matter to me. So, you know, ask questions, try to, you know, people, so on and so forth. So there you go. Incarnational versus isolation.
Yeah, it almost sounds like you're saying that the point of the whole thing is the incarnation of the Son of God. I don't know. Who would have thought, right?
Totally. Yeah, exactly. Wow. What a great narrative. Someone should write a book on that.
Well, dude, thanks for, I know you're busy. I know you're feeling sick. So thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
Dude, anytime. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Jason, this is Jeremiah from the, you know, the 909. Anyway, so I have just a question with the proceeding with a comment. On several episodes back, and several of the criticisms I hear from agnostics is that the scriptures, especially the Old Testament, you have, say, God laying out dietary laws, God laying out ritual laws, but God doesn't address things like slavery, sexism, things of that sort. And it seems like a very valid argument, because, you know, God somehow forced slavery and all these other crazy things. But if we're to take the words of the prophets later on seriously, they seem to chide people not for their religious observations, their dietary laws, or other things, but for the injustice that they do, even though they are keeping those laws. I mean, in fact, God actually says, I don't care about any of your ritualistic laws. What I hate is your love of injustice. And so he does address slavery, how they oppress the poor, how they don't care for those that need to be cared for. So my question is what about that? You know, if God is actually addressing these things that we say that we care about, how do we answer the people that say, that criticize the scriptures, that God somehow doesn't care and he only cares about these other things? Look forward to hearing your answer, and take care. Bye.
All right. Thanks, Jeremiah from the 909, for the question. I'll address the actual question, and then I'm going to springboard, okay? I think you're right. I think it's absolutely correct that in the Old Testament, despite the fact that many criticize God for being overly scrupulous about, you know, ridiculous shit that doesn't matter, the fact is that God does indeed call out his people in the Old Testament for their injustices. You know, and despite the fact that some people see the Old Testament God of Israel as sort of, you know, in the words of Jesus, straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel, in other words, being overly preoccupied with the minutiae of the law, what you wear, who you talk to, your dietary restrictions, whether you keep the Sabbath, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, certainly, on the one hand, it is true that the God of the Old Testament is very, very scrupulous about that stuff, right? I mean, one guy got stoned to death for gathering sticks on the Sabbath. And then, of course, there's the issue of Onan, literally the issue of Onan, Onan's issue. He was the guy who married his brother's wife after his brother died in order to raise up an heir for his brother. But in the act, he pulls out and basically just splooges on the ground and God kills him, right? So, yeah, you know, God was a bit uptight, I suppose, in Old Testament times about these things that we would often consider sort of like peripheral, secondary, tertiary kind of things. However, in the prophets especially, you do see God calling out Israel for their injustice toward the poor, their injustices toward the oppressed, their injustices toward the stranger and the refugee among them. right? God says things like, I hate, I despise your feasts, and your sacrifices are an abomination to me. You know, and Jesus even quotes this when he's talking to the Pharisees, and they're all going on and on about like the letter of the law and crossing all their T's and dotting all their I's. And Jesus says, hey, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. In other words, what God desires, according to Jesus, is a heart filled with compassion over strict, meticulous obedience to some external set of commands. Right? And so, Jeremiah, I think you're right. But speaking of this, piggybacking on this, springboarding from this to something else, what if we were to read those kind of social justice passages, you know, even from the New Testament? Let's take the New Testament. What if we read these kinds of passages not as frozen in time snapshots of what divine morality is supposed to forever resemble, right? Because that's kind of how we read them. You know, you sort of look at, we often, especially fundamentalists, you know, look at the Bible and look at the New Testament's kind of ethic and instructions and whatever. And what they see is this is sort of like a time capsule. You know, this is a snapshot. Frozen in time, this is what God wants. This is God's will, right? We look at the instructions of Paul or Peter as timeless truths, like, right, eternal moral principles. Well, what if we didn't? What if we didn't read it like that, and instead we saw these instructions as kinds of trajectories that we have every reason to expect will continue? You know, for example, slavery. I would argue that the New Testament is miles ahead of its time, years ahead of its time when it comes to the issue of slavery. Slavery in the Roman Empire, as most of you know, and in antiquity in general, was just very, very common. You know, it wasn't the same kind of chattel slavery that we have in the history of the United States, but it was often indentured servitude, or if people were captured as prisoners of war, or if people were just poor and they would be slaves for a time. It was just common for every home in antiquity and in the Roman Empire in particular to have slaves. Well, Paul the Apostle talks about slavery and he says, "Masters, I want you to dignify and respect your slaves, because you have a master in heaven. Don't oppress them, don't harm them, but treat them with care. Treat them with respect. Treat them with dignity," right? Which, of course, is a massive step forward when you compare that ethic to kind of what was common in the Roman Empire of the day. But it's still woefully insufficient, isn't it? I mean, the New Testament, taken as a timeless expression of God's moral will, is woefully insufficient on the issue of slavery, right? It took about 18 centuries before we actually caught up with where I would argue that trajectory was leading us, right? It's not that hard to envision the fact that when Paul talks about slaves as being worthy of the respect of their masters, that eventually, if you really kind of carry this out and play this out, eventually slavery is going to be abolished. Now, it wasn't abolished immediately because, you know, it takes time to turn a big vessel, you know, around. It takes time to really grapple with and come to grips with the ramifications of teaching that we receive, ethical teaching that we receive, right? So it wasn't until like the 18th century, 19th century, that slavery was truly abolished in the Western world, right? But the reason it was abolished, I would argue, is because of the social justice stuff that Paul said. Paul didn't say, free your slaves. I don't know if the world was ready to hear that kind of message yet, but he put the ball in motion, right? He planted the seed. The trajectory was set. And it just was a matter of time until we would live in a world where there are no slaves, okay? The same, I would argue, is true of what the New Testament has to say about women. Starting with Jesus, who, unlike virtually any other rabbi or religious figure of his day, Jesus respected and dignified women in a way that was scandalous to even his own disciples. You know, he would sit down and speak with them. He would talk with them. He would converse. He would teach them. He would make them feel like they mattered, right? And there are times where he's doing this and the disciples return from buying food in town or whatever, and they see him sitting down by a well with a woman going, why are you talking to her? It's uncouth. It's not right for a rabbi to dignify a woman by speaking to her directly. In fact, in John 4, when he actually addresses the Samaritan woman, she kind of looks behind her over her shoulder, even perhaps mockingly going, are you talking to me? Like, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask a question of me, a Samaritan woman, right? She was as shocked as anyone else. And carrying forth into the epistles, you know, Paul talks about husbands and wives are to submit mutually to one another, and that husbands and wives are to forfeit their own well-being, their own autonomy, to sacrifice for the needs of the other if need be. And so in this way, I would argue that the New Testament is miles ahead of its time, but also, like on the issue of slavery, it's woefully insufficient, right? There's other stuff in the New Testament about women should keep silent in the churches and all of this. What if what the social justice teaching of the New Testament does is rather than giving us a suspended, you know, in time snapshot of what God's will is forever, what if it's just planting a seed? What if it is setting a ball in motion? What if it is setting a trajectory that is going to continue on long after the people who wrote the New Testament are gone? Now, this obviously is going to give us pause and make us think about, you know, what are we to think about feminism? What are we to think about equality and equal pay for equal work and all of these kinds of issues that are so important right now? Well, if you're just quoting the New Testament as though it's eternal, timeless truth, then you're going to come down on the asshole side of all of these questions. But if you're willing to see the trajectory there, then I think it's going to open up a lot of avenues in our own thinking and also open up our hearts. The story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery in John 8. You know, the Pharisees bring this woman half naked to Jesus who was caught in the act of sleeping with someone who's not her husband. And what does Jesus do? He forgives her. He forgives her. Well, what if that were seen as the first step in a bigger trajectory? Now, what would John 8 say to our present culture if seen in this way? So, something to think about. Thanks, Jeremiah. Now, almost time to wrap up here. We're running out of time, but before we do, I need a minute.
Now, it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
I went to the doctor for the first time in ages. I told you I went yesterday. I told you I went this morning. I also went yesterday. You know, I haven't had insurance for several years, either because I couldn't afford it, or I didn't qualify from my work, or my work didn't offer it, or whatever. But I've been without insurance, and I've paid a penalty financially for that when I pay my taxes. But now I'm able to get on Washington State's kind of like poor person insurance. It's the kind of insurance they'd offer like every human being in a civilized country like Canada, for example. But here you have to be, you know, you have to be like an utter financial failure to qualify for it. And, you know, yay for me, I do. And so I was sitting in the doctor's office yesterday, and I have incredibly high blood pressure. I was diagnosed a few years ago with really high blood pressure. And ever since I've felt this death sentence hanging over me. I've literally been on the verge of a stroke for years. I mean, you should have seen the look on my doctor's face as she took my blood pressure and she pointed to the blood pressure poster on the wall and said, "You're the guy we have this up for. My goal is to scare the living shit out of you right now." But you see, here's where I get all pissed off. Why do I have to wait till I'm poor enough to actually be finally able to afford to see a doctor and get the medication that I need? You know, why are so many people in this country in favor of a for-profit healthcare system that's way more expensive and way less efficient than other civilized nations? And worse, why is it always Christians leading the charge to deny healthcare to as many people as possible? It's Christians leading the charge to say no to this. I mean, a fraction of our defense budget could pay for universal health care for everyone in this country, and we'd be plenty safe in spite of it. But no, we need to use imagined threats as excuses to not solve actual problems. We can't, you know, stop outspending every other nation in the world on our defense budget because something bad might happen, despite the fact that bad things are happening every day to people who don't have access to healthcare. And yet, no, we have to just theorize some calamity as an excuse to not solve the real calamities that are happening everywhere around us. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, I forgot. Jesus is the great physician, right? So I should just trust him to heal my hypertension. You know, I actually have more respect for like Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Scientists or whoever who actually refuse to turn to medicine. Yeah, I have more respect for them, you know, because they say, well, we trust in Jesus to heal us, than I do for the typical conservative evangelical who wants to deny health care to me, but instead runs to the doctor to get medicine the first time he gets a sniffle. You know, for the Christian Scientists or the Jehovah's Witness, at least they're willing to die for their faith, you know, right? But for the kind of traditional conservative evangelical who have great insurance already but don't want poor people to get any, well, those people have a nice hot corner of hell to look forward to. Well, not really, but, you know, still.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, to play us out of the episode, this is one of my favorite bands. They have been around for a good while. I started listening to them probably in 2004, 2005. They're called The National. They just put out a new album called Sleep Well Beast, and it's good. And one of my, actually, it's rare that this happens when I've been listening to a band for so long, but one of the songs on this has probably kind of wormed its way into my top five songs by The National. So check it out. These guys are great. I saw them at the Showbox in Seattle a few years ago on their tour of their album Boxer. But this is from their new album, Sleep Well Beast. This is called Day I Die. See you next week. Later.
Like your own.